Not long after we moved to England in 2007, on a bright and unseasonably warm half-term holiday morning, when Joel had to work and before I had a job, I decided to take the boys on a nature walk I'd heard about. A new friend had given me rough instructions off the A34, describing the area as being one of her kids' favorite places to go and visit. It had a wooded area that purportedly became lush with snowdrops and bluebells, and an open field and a sand pit. Our boys, at that point aged 9, 7, and 4, thought that might be okay. They didn't like walks very much, they still don't, but the sand pit part sounded intriguing. I love woodland walks, so it seemed a good plan to me. I packed a few things to eat, and we piled into the car just before lunchtime for our brief outing. It was a bit of a stressful start because I was still learning to drive on the opposite side of the road, and this was the first time I'd ventured out onto the motorway. So complete silence was required from the back seat as I fiercely concentrated on staying in the right lane, that is to say, keeping to the correct side on the left side of the road. It was hard to keep saying to myself, keep left, keep left, keep left, because you're supposed to keep right, keep right, keep right. But anyway, given that we were heading south from North Oxford, see, I'm directionally challenged, this will become apparent. Heading from North Oxford down toward Abingdon, and given that it was Kit and Finney and Eli who were in the back seat of the car, silence was a bit of an ask. So we were all relieved when I finally found the little bit of tarmac that my friend had described. By that point, the boys were so wound up, it was like a bit like having three anxious puppies who'd realized they're getting to go for a run in the field, sitting in the back of the car. So they could hardly contain themselves as they tumbled out over one another. I grabbed the bag of lunch snacks. I spotted the sign marked footpath, and I steered them all in that direction. Eli's little legs struggled to keep up, and the two older ones wondered how long they'd have to walk before we found the sand pit. Not long, I promised. Well, it hadn't looked far on the map that I'd consulted in the car. Unfortunately, we'd been walking for about 15 minutes already by the time I realized that I'd left the map behind, which meant that I had to decide either to turn around and get the map, effectively adding another half hour to our journey, or just keep on going. So, of course, we kept on going. Not long after the query, there was a loud yelp and a howl of pain from Eli. He had tripped and was thereby introduced to stinging nettle, something I'd not encountered for several years myself, so I wasn't even sure at first why he was howling in so much pain. I took out the water bottle I had with us and poured half of it over his little hand to wash and soothe it. Kit quickly scrambled for some dockweed. He'd heard about it at school and knew just how it worked. Tears dried and crisis behind us, we trudged on with occasional whimpers and sniffles. Finally, after another 5 or 10 minutes, we came upon the sand pit we'd been searching for. And the boys had a great time. There were a couple of dune-like ridges, which reminded them of the sands back in Massachusetts at the beaches, and a small cave, some stubby tree stumps to clamber about on. Finally, fun to be had. We broke out our sandwiches and drained the juice bottles, and the sun shone brilliantly. For the moment, the effort and the tears and the frustration all felt worth it. But this being England, predictably it didn't take long before the dark clouds rolled in and the temperature suddenly dropped as the wind picked up. I packed up our wrappers and rubbish and said to the boys, "Okay, guys, let's head back to the car before the rain falls." Needless to say, we didn't make it back before the skies opened, but at least the shower was brief. We walked on and on. The path, which had looked correct when we set off, no longer looked familiar, but I wasn't about to say that to the boys. I figured we'd eventually see something recognizable. After 45 minutes or so, the boys were getting annoyed and tired, and I silently questioned why I'd ever thought this adventure was a good idea. I offered up silent prayers, which morphed into bargains and promises. Just give me a sign. Send me someone. Give me a distinct sense of direction. You never have given me that, God. Please, in this moment. We didn't have a map. We were newcomers to a foreign land. And although I knew about a Right to Roam Act or something like that, I wasn't sure that it included going through people's back gardens or any amount of wooded land. And by that point, I was starting to feel desperate. I'd had to pick up Eli and carry him on my shoulders, on my back, in my arms. Did I say he was four? He was four and a half, and he was solid. What was meant to be an adventure, a fun outing for a couple of hours, had turned into something of an endurance test. All three boys, to their credit, were mostly staying on top of their frustration, as if they had a choice. But after an hour and a half of wandering, I was on the brink of tears. The intermittent sun was lower and lower on the horizon. The temperature was no longer rising when the sun did appear. I had no idea where we were, no mobile phone, no GPS, and three little boys who were depending on me to get them home. We were all tired, hungry, and thirsty. We were so thirsty. Finally, at about 4:30, we found ourselves in a little neighborhood with a few houses. Someone just happened to be in her front garden, and I asked whether she knew where the such-and-such pub, I can't even remember the name of it, was, I haven't been back there, down the road from where we'd parked. "Oh my," she responded. "I'd say you're about a mile and a half from there." Fighting back tears of fatigue and frustration, silently wishing she'd offer us a ride that of course she couldn't responsibly offer us, I thanked her very much, picked up Eli again, and said to the boys, "Okay, guys, we just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other. We can do this." Inevitably, there were tears and moaning, which I tried to stifle. But off we went. Nearly an hour later, we managed to stagger back to the car. It was dusk. We were all exhausted, and we collapsed into our seats. The boys understandably whined about their thirst, and I prayed that the pub down the road was open. I knew a glass of anything sweet and carbonated would fully redeem me with them, and I was absolutely desperate for a glass of water. The pub was closed, and it was a long ride home. But tap water never tasted so gorgeous, and our beds were particularly comfortable that night. Now, it's probably a bit much to compare those few hours to the experience of the Israelites, or even more pointedly, to the plight of some 783 million people in our world today who don't have access to clean drinking water, much less adequate food and accommodation. But I've reflected on that day often since then, and while I recognize the broadly privileged existence I'm blessed to inhabit, there's something of a spiritual metaphor in today's experience, or in that day's experiences for me. Because as we trudged around, putting one foot in front of the other, just trying to find our way back to the car so that we could get home, I couldn't help noticing how my mood, my prayers, my attitude toward life itself changed numerous times on that journey. In a single afternoon, a mere few hours, I noticed how my behaviors and my spirit impacted on the boys, and how theirs either inspired or challenged my own. We don't live in isolation, and our spirits can jostle and jar those we journey with, just as they can encourage or soothe them. Likewise, the people we surround ourselves with can inspire us and draw us into a deeper awareness of God's nearness to us, or they can obscure the divine light. Excuse me. Or they can obscure the divine light if we let them. And chances are, If we are challenging others or being challenged by them, it's because one or the other, perhaps both of us, are thirsty. Sometimes it's for the kind of water that we'll need to drink again. But even more often, we're thirsty for that living water that Jesus offered to the Samaritan woman. The same water that the Israelites were desperate for as they wandered around in the wilderness of sin, feeling physical hunger and thirst, but also longing for the water of hope and reassurance that the God who had pledged to journey with them really was still with them, still loved them, and would bless them, especially in those moments when life felt like anything but a blessing. What better way to drink deeply of that reassurance, to share that hope and promise, than by telling each other about how Jesus has given us living water, just as the Samaritan woman did with her friends. We gather as a faith community to share our stories, our ancient stories and our contemporary stories, our daily life stories, to talk about the ways and the places we've recognized God's love and presence, strength and companionship with us along the paths of life, both difficult and pleasant. And in hearing the testimony of others, as we observe the truth of God's Spirit spilling forth from others, we can begin to feel our own spiritual thirst slaked. We gather as a faith community to share our stories, our hopes, our anxieties, our disappointments, and our experiences of resurrection joy and transformation, because we recognize that we are on this journey together. Different experiences, divergent lives, but one and the same God. We thirst individually and collectively for that living water, and we are invited to drink of its nourishing properties as we share our cup with one another. Across the past several years, a growing number of our congregation have told the story of their personal faith journey during our service of worship. This morning we welcome Stephen Bell, who was baptized here at Wheatley URC nearly 5 years ago, and who's offered to share a bit about his experience of receiving living water. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you, Tanya, for that introduction. And yes, it was on Easter Day, 5 years since I was baptized here, along with my older daughter, Emily. I remember that Tanya was quite generous with the water. Maybe she felt that there was plenty to be washed away from my past. In a way, she was right. I could never have imagined as a child entering a church, and certainly not speaking at a lectern. And it is certainly something that makes me feel uncomfortable. But nevertheless, Tanya has asked me to speak about my journey. I was born in Manchester to English parents, but we soon moved north to the village of Eaglesham near Glasgow. Neither of my parents were churchgoers. My father was actively opposed to Christianity, whilst my mother was brought up quite strictly by parents who were both very active in their local Baptist church. She seemed keen to escape from church going and found a good partner in my father. I don't know the reason for my father's rejection of Christianity, but he never mentioned going to church as a child or any bad experience at church. At primary school, though, I remember a visit by the local Church of Scotland minister, Reverend Bennett, who came in to tell us some stories about Jesus. I was disappointed that he was not a more frequent visitor, as most schooling then was very dry. At secondary school, religion was far from my mind. And there were no visits from a local minister. Scottish nationalism and communism were much more interesting subjects of conversation in between solving physics problems. And given the sectarian bigotry in Glasgow at that time, especially associated with football and the provocative Orange Lodge marches, it was an easy decision to avoid Christianity. Going up to Oxford, it was hard to avoid Christianity, with chapels in every college, and at Hartford, a chaplain eager to meet new students and drink tea with them. But I found the Anglican version of Christianity even less appealing than the Calvinism of the Church of Scotland. The choral music in the college chapels was wonderful, though, and I also occasionally went to concerts in London. One of these was a performance of the Seven Last Words of the Cross by Haydn as a string quartet, with short sermons between each of the movements. This was the first time that I managed to reflect on the story of the death and resurrection of Christ and whether it had any meaning for myself. The sermons were more than about incredible miracles I'd heard of, but a story of human suffering that seemed all too real. A few years ago, I think sometime after Emily was born, I was clearing out a cupboard of some chess scores. These are the records of the moves of a chess game. And it looks something like this. They were all falling onto the floor, and I wanted to store them more safely, as I'd been a very keen chess player. I started to look at them and remembered some of the games, both wins and difficult losses. Most of them were from the time in the 90s after finishing my DPhil, when I was living in London and working in Slough. Looking more closely at one of them, I saw the words, "No longer conform to the ordinary pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind." From Romans 12. I noted this down as I passed a church on my way to a chess venue. Mostly the slogans outside churches had compelled me to walk faster. But here was a very startling and challenging thought. I didn't associate it with what I had seen of established churches, which seemed to be more intolerant and dogmatic than searching for truth. I was not happy with how my life was in London, and I was very grateful for this prod. I continued to read books from the Bible, but not in any systematic way. As I listened to some radio programs such as Thought for the Day, I would probably investigate further. So this is the way I came towards Christianity, not by attending church, but by reading books of the Bible. As most of you know, I am married to Ulrika, who is a minister of the United Reformed Church. We met only 8 years ago, before I was a member of a church. I think that we both regarded marriage as a bit of an outreach project. It still is sometimes. Our marriage has been blessed in many ways, with children and an active church life. Little by little, reading the Bible is one thing, but the support, encouragement, and acceptance by others has really nourished me. Church life has enabled me to deepen my faith an understanding of Christianity by shared activities, spoken and written words, and friendships. And I'd like to thank you all for that. At Aston Tyrold United Reformed Church recently, there was a day of baking with bread, with baking bread with prayer and silence while we're waiting for the dough to rise. After returning, I felt more confident about baking, but also remembered Ulrika's nostalgia for real German bread. No friends or relations visit us from Germany without bringing rye bread, usually with lots of pumpkin seeds. I felt ready to make sourdough bread. This bread is made using a starter of flour and water, which is mixed to introduce air and then placed in a sealed container. The starter mixture ferments because of the wild yeast found in air everywhere. After several days, it has a very satisfying alcoholic aroma. The starter is later added to unleavened dough, and the mixture will rise if left for some time, in fact, many hours. In Matthew 13, Jesus says that the kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked all through the dough. With sourdough, it doesn't even need to be added. The yeast appears from an invisible source and works its way through. Jesus must surely have meant the yeast to signify the Holy Spirit. I feel that this is how it has worked in my life, a real but mysterious presence, which by grace has revealed itself as a love of Christ. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.